Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. Dow Automotive Systems, improving durability and increasing design flexibility with Betamate structural adhesives at DowBetamate.com. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.
This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 85 for Thursday, January 6, 2011. Let's do a show. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at outoflinedetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern or 2400 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Out of Line After Hours in the iTunes Store. Well, here we are, Thursday night. It's another Out of Line After Hours. Joining me, as always, is the auto extremist. He's in the house, Peter DeLorenzo. Peter, great having you here, as
great
always.
Great to be here, John, with Mr. Bob Lutz.
Yeah, our guest. Bob, great having you here.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So we're going to start the show a little bit differently. We've already got phone calls pouring in, and Ben, why don't we bring up the first one of those, and we'll use that to kick off the show.
Hey, guys, it's Jonathan Brown in Old DePan, New Jersey. John McElroy, Peter DeLorenzo, you guys are the best. It's 7 a.m. Thursday morning. We're pumped. 12 hours from now, we're going to have the man of the year, Bob Lutz, man of the industry, on the show. Bob, you're the best. Your products are the best. The way you carry yourself, everything you've done for the industry is the best. And we want to know when your book is coming out, what the title's going to be, and how soon can we buy it. Anyways, thanks a lot. Bob, I think you're the best. Have a good one. Everybody on the internet is hunkering down, waiting for the show to start tonight. Have a good one.
Thanks, Jonathan. So, yeah, who, what, when, where, why of the book?
Well, it'll be published in June. It's called Car Guys versus Bean Counters, The Battle for the Soul of American Business is the subtitle. And it'll be Portfolio Press, which is the business section of Penguin Books. They have international distribution rights. And I just felt that I was at GM at a very interesting time. The last of the old culture, which people like Fritz Henderson and Rick Wagner were doing their best to change, and then the ultimate decline, Chapter 11, and rebirth, which was a financial cleansing. I don't deal with that much because Ratner already did the book on that one.
But we'll talk about that, too.
But I wanted to demonstrate by the book, the whole first section of the book is called Failed Culture of Excellence, which was basically the theme of General Motors for decades of a lot of well-intentioned, highly intelligent people thinking they were doing the right thing and doing everything right except producing world-class products. And how that doesn't work, and that it was only when, with Rick Wagner's permission and encouragement, I was able to change the product development culture away from let's just make it good enough to where it'll pass, make it good enough to where we have an entry, make it good enough to where it's competitive average, to an intense focus on best looking, best handling, quietest, longest lasting, best design, highest customer value. And the success that General Motors is having now is due to this focus on world-class products. And that is a core message of mine that I really want to get out, is that the business approach that's taught by the American graduate schools of business, and I always have to point out here that I have an MBA myself, but I got it the way sailors get tattoos, which is before I knew any better. And it's basically the business schools teach a cost optimization model. And it is assumed that the customer will be there. Well, in today's competitive environment, if you don't have the world's best, the customer isn't going to be there. And that's fundamentally the message of the book. The nation's business schools are not going to like it. I don't think I'll ever be invited to give a speech at a business school again.
No more
honorary degrees.
I don't know. I think you're on the leading edge of a trend here. I think there's a growing recognition, very small right now, but a growing recognition that this MBA approach, just smash it down to the lowest possible cost, and everything will be hunky-dory. I think that thinking of what you're talking about is starting to grow.
Well, you're right, because I've met with the heads of, just casually and by accident, met with the heads of several business schools, including Wharton School of Finance and UC Berkeley Haas Business School, and they asked me about the book, and I said, well, you're not going to like it. And they say, why? And then I tell them, and then they say, wow, you've got to come and talk to us. So I see maybe there's a dawning of the realization that what has been taught has not worked. I always like the example of Steve Jobs, a very right-brained individual, highly creative. I use his example in the book. And Steve Jobs was focused on innovation, and he had a passion for his product. But at one point, the board, as you'll recall, maybe 15 years ago, threw him out because he wasn't businesslike enough. They hired a brilliant, high-level, proven CEO, a former CEO of Pepsi-Cola, and he organized it by sectors, put people in charge of sectors. Each sector is going to analyze the competition and do products. It was this highly regimented, analytical approach, dispassionate, you know. And Apple went right into the ground, and Steve Jobs had to come roaring back, did the iPad or the iPod, the iPhone, the iPad, first redesigned the workstations. And I mean, look at now Apple. You go into an Apple store, you can hardly get in.
Right.
It's so crowded.
It's crazy.
So, and that's, there is a place in the world for IBM, for MBAs, for the analytical approach to business. It's good as a counterbalance. But when you're doing a product for customers, it helps to have people in charge who are passionate about the product and passionate about the service. And it affects every sector of America. You know, why do people pay premium prices for imported beer? Because none of the big American breweries can produce a beer that is in any way comparable to a good German or Japanese or Mexican beer. Why are the leading hotel chains in the United States foreign-owned? Why is it when we fly the Pacific, we would prefer to fly Singapore Airlines, JAL, or Qantas, rather than an American airline? Why is it when we fly the Atlantic, we would prefer Swiss or Lufthansa? Because every sector of American business has been MBA'd to death. And that's the message of the book, and I want to get it out.
And I think going back to what you were saying about GM is they had the capability of doing it right. You didn't go in and fire a bunch of people and bring in a bunch of outsiders.
No, you're absolutely right. GM, and my experience is admittedly a little bit, it's only four automobile companies, not a dozen.
More than anybody else.
But I will say of the four automobile companies I've worked for, General Motors has the greatest technical depth of any automobile company going. And now with the new era of the electrification of the automobile, nobody has more highly qualified electrochemists, battery experts, and so forth. And it's in any area you look at, whether it's automatic transmissions, which, you know, even renowned European companies tend to buy from suppliers. General Motors, the guys can whip out new automatic transmissions. It's just not a problem. Engine technology, whatever you want to look at, General Motors has an enormous technical depth and also a brilliant design department. What was wrong was people were being held back and told, don't make it too good because we have a cost objective. And that's okay. I mean, you have to have some cost discipline, but the number one thing has to be, with this new vehicle, we want to do the best looking, highest value, most pleasing and vehicle in its class. And sometimes, you know, you target that and it's 3 years out, and sometimes you're surprised because somebody pulls something even better out in the meantime. But at least you'll be number two. But if you don't use that approach, by the time the car comes out, you're run-of-the-mill, in the average. There's no compelling reason to buy the vehicle. And the interesting thing is GM was so incredibly successful in trucks. Why? Because the truck guys excused themselves from that philosophy. The Corvette guys did, too. The Corvette guys said, hey, don't tell us about cost. We're going to do a great car. And I remember saying to Dave Hill, the VLE of the C6, I said, well, gee, Dave, you're putting in another $200 here. He says, yeah, that's right. But, you know, the Corvette customer will respect that, and it adds value to the car. And the same thing with trucks. The truck guys have this clear vision of who the competition is. And, by the way, in all three companies, the truck culture is outstanding. They look at each other. They have a deep knowledge of the competitor's product. And with the new truck, they want to beat the competition on fuel economy, payload, horsepower, torque, towing capacity. And if they don't achieve that, they consider themselves to have failed. And in the car end of the business, it was a more sort of a commodity thinking, which has now, you know, blissfully changed. But when you talk about technological capability, I submit no other automobile company in the world could have pulled the Volt off, which is technologically the most complex, most difficult to engineer, the most has probably more computing power by a factor of by several multiples of the space shuttle, and I guess the BlackBerry does too. But it's a car that I don't think anybody else could have pulled off in that time frame.
Do you consider the Volt name your top three vehicles you're associated with in your career?
Well, everybody always says Dodge Viper, and
no,
sure,
I'm letting you say it.
In terms of transforming the image of the company, of a company that was on its way out, the Viper does stand as a monument that sometimes you have to do something irrational, seemingly irrational, to get people's attention again. So the Dodge Viper would be one. The Volt, definitely. I'm very proud of that vehicle. It's from a resource utilization standpoint, it's at the other end of the spectrum, but so what? It stands out in a different direction. And then I was also very, very proud of the Chrysler LH cars, the first generation, Intrepid, Concord, LHS, and so forth.
You know, a couple of the guys on the Nissan Leaf program told me they greatly admire the Volt for exactly what you're talking about. They said, you know, all we did was take batteries, plug it to a motor, and we're done. And they said, yeah, when you look at what had to go into the Leaf, they were admiring how much effort GM put, especially in the time frame that you did it in.
Yeah. No, it was an all-out program. It was almost like the Manhattan Project in World War II. And even when we were staring at Chapter 11, and resources were being constrained all over the company, and a lot of programs were delayed. You know, Camaro convertible was delayed a year. I mean, a lot of stuff was pushed out.
The C7.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, C7 was pushed out. A lot of things were pushed out, but the Volt was never short of resources.
Going back to what you were saying about on business, I'm just curious about this point, what your thoughts are. You always have these engineers who want to do good stuff, and the designers and whatnot, the whole technical community. But the guys with the money run everything, you know? They got the gold, they've got the rules. So how do you balance this need for driving financial discipline and yet still come out with terrific product?
I always say there's got to be a yin and a yang. You know, you can't let the engineers run everything. That can be very dangerous, or the product guys. Let's say product guys, because it's like the product guys are the engine and drivetrain of a vehicle. the MBAs and the cost guys are the brakes and the steering. So you really need both. And the question is one of balance. But I maintain that you're better off having somebody at the helm who is passionate about product excellence, and like Ferdinand Piëch at Volkswagen, you know, he made some colossal mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Even recently.
Like the Volkswagen, the Phaeton,
which is
an ultimate bad idea, great car, bad idea, wrong brand. And I'm sure that everybody was scared to tell him it was a bad idea.
Because if they do, they find themselves in Siberia.
Yeah, exactly.
A week later.
Exactly. So I'm sure that the finance guys at Volkswagen probably sometimes tore their hair out and were worried. But overall, with probably some restraint, which was necessary, some mistakes, which are unfortunate, but as Wayne Gretzky says, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. Overall, Volkswagen Group today is an enormously successful company, and I think on the way to passing Toyota to arguably be number one, unless General Motors comes back up into that position.
As long as Volkswagen doesn't get lost in trying to be number one, because I think they're...
Yeah, that's always the risk. Yeah. That's what did Toyota in.
Yeah, absolutely.
For sure. So, but I think a car company which is led by someone who is passionate about doing the best vehicles in the world with some guidance and restraint from the people who are watching the money is going to be more successful than a car company that, as was so typical in the American companies, you set your financial goals 5 years out, you compute your cash flow, you look at your volumes, you look at your margins, and you say, that's where we're going to be in 5 years. Now let's find the most cost-effective way to get there. That doesn't work. You can't even run a restaurant that way. Good restaurants are run and owned by people who are passionate about good food. And at some point, you have to step in and tell the chef, hey, wait a minute, you know, Go
easy on the truffles this week.
Go easy on the white truffles. Okay. At some point, there is a legitimate need for finance people, but they shouldn't be running it. That's the problem. When the finance people run it, that, and you have, and everybody feels constrained that they wish they could do better, but we can't. That's a disaster.
Well, I think one of Rick's greatest achievements in his career was to bring you on to General Motors, because at that time, General Motors was seriously in danger, in jeopardy. And I remember we talked after he called you, and Bob said he went back and read all my columns just to get his head back into the game. But the best thing...
Yeah, the column was the one that I... He said, how about Bob Lutz? Nah, too old.
Yeah. But the best thing Bob did was... Here was General Motors with this magnificent legacy of design, mm-hmm. with two of the greatest guys ever, you know, Harley Earl and Bill Mitchell. And the best thing he did for... car enthusiasts was to go to design and pull them up by the lapels and say, hey, you guys, just run for it.
But, Peter, it was worse than that.
Yeah.
It was organized to where Wayne Cherry, who is the vice president of design, had no authority over the design, because you had these 13 or 14 vehicle line executives, and a head designer was assigned to each VLE, and the VLEs made the calls on the design. Now, the VLEs had different priorities. They had other priorities than excellent design. Their priorities was make the cost objective, do it on time, reuse the right level of parts. And at the time, there was such an emphasis on timely delivery. No more program delays. We're not going to allow any more of those. The first guy who misses an introduction date is going to be history. And so the whole focus was getting it on time, whether it was any good or not. And with this split up of design, no wonder every car, there was no family resemblance among anything. And I would talk to Wayne and say, Wayne, we'd look at some products that were in the hopper, and I'd say, Wayne, this is terrible. And he said, I know. I said, this thing is coming out, and the vice president of design says it's terrible? He says, yeah. And I said, how can that happen? He said, I have no authority over it. The vehicle line executive said it's okay. We had to hit the cutoff date, and that's it. A Saturn Ion was a case like that. Pontiac Grand Prix. The Pontiac Grand Prix, the last one, researched worse than the model before it. We would have been better off keeping the old one. The vehicle line executive said, this is fine. It's what I want. We're going with it. Wayne hated it. Wayne hated a lot of stuff. And we'd have these contracts where when a vehicle was approved for final execution, manufacturing had to sign off, engineering had to sign off, marketing had to sign off.
And maybe they should have had a final execution.
Yeah, yeah. there was like this document that was kind of like framed the contract of the car. Half the contracts Wayne Cherry wouldn't sign. He just said, I am not putting my name to that vehicle. So the first thing I did was this was not popular with the vehicle line executives, but I yanked.
You camped in design, right? You were in design when you first went to GM. You were in design all the time. You were.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't you have an office there for a while?
You mean when I came back?
Yeah, when you
came back. Oh, yeah, I had an office out in design.
Yeah.
And, but the first and I think maybe best thing was to take design responsibility back from the VLEs and give the head of design authority over every piece of design work done at General Motors, and then try to expand that to the whole visual representation of the company. And Ed Welburn is doing a great job on that, to where design now controls auto show displays, which is where it should be.
That's the way it used to be in the heyday.
Harley Earl. Corporate aircraft interiors were done by Harley Earl and his
the group. Motorama, the shows.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this was all, it was a design-driven company.
It still makes me sad to drive out to Metro and see that Harley Earl design logo, which appeared on the original Firebird concept cars, which became the logo for GM Air Transport Service, I wrote about on the site.
Yeah, it's a Speedbird symbol.
Beautiful, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just sitting there on the empty hangar now.
Hey, we got to take a break here.
Yep.
Because we've got to go to one of our sponsors. And apropos, we need to talk about the Chevrolet Cruze at Chevrolet.com/cruise. And there's all kinds of stuff that's packed into this.
That's premium thinking, what you talked about earlier.
Yep.
It's, you know, the Cruze was the demarcation. I mean, the Cobalt was the old GM. The
yep.
Cruze was the neat
yep.
GM. And the idea of, look, cost is going to go up.
Yep.
But the delivery and satisfaction to the consumer is going to go way up with it.
Well, this is what I call adding value faster than you're adding cost. And that's really the recipe. And sure, the Cruze is a very expensive car, but it's sold out in Australia, sold out in China, sold out in Korea, sold out in Europe, and it's getting far higher transaction prices than the Cobalt or any predecessor ever did, because people recognize the value. It's first of all a fairly large vehicle. It's very well appointed. The interior is beautiful. There's a lot of sound deadening in the vehicle. It's got great fuel economy. I mean, it's just a wonderful.
I like the dynamics of it. It feels good.
The dynamics are out,
yeah.
But you don't get that for nothing.
Yeah.
So there's a lot more cost in the vehicle, but when you look at how much more money the company is getting for it, the cost pales into insignificance. Now, one of the things that worries me is that there are people at GM who say, I think we overachieved on the Cruze. And
But they were those same people say we overachieved on the Malibu.
Yeah, and overachieved on the LaCrosse.
And overachieved on the CTS-V.
Buick, Enclave and so forth.
Minions, we've talked about the vast gray middle that, you know, they rise up, you know.
Yeah.
And,
And, you know, last week, too, we were talking about, because one of the questions...
Excuse me, yeah. But there's no such thing as overachieving on a new car. No. If that car is successful, you haven't overachieved. You've done what you were supposed to do.
Well, one of the questions we had gotten before was, hey, how come it's not selling that well? And what we had talked about was, whoa, we've only got 2 months of sales figures. Give it another month or two here.
The Cruise is going to come on really strong.
Well, it did in December. Sales jumped another 25%. It broke through 10,000 units for the month. I think it's twice as good, more than twice as good as the Ford Fiesta right now in sales.
Well, yeah. I would hope.
The real challenge for the Cruise will be the...
But here, let me knock off, because Chevrolet wants me to do this, and it's apropos of having you here, talking about adding all kinds of stuff. Remote start, 9-speaker, Pioneer premium sound system, XM satellite, that's available, USB port for your iPod, 40-gig hard drive in the LTZ model, steering wheel-mounted audio controls, Bluetooth connectivity, two accessory power outlets. Maybe this is where they're talking about overachieving.
No, I think a lot of that, connectivity today in the car, USB ports, power outlets, and all of that stuff, you've got to have it. You can, but that is an area which is fashionable right now, and it's easy to get yourself sidetracked and load more of that stuff in than the customer can use. And as you could see, that Consumer Reports just took the Ford Edge and the Lincoln version off of the recommended list because of the difficulty in dealing with all the electronics and the interface, the difficulty of the driver interface with the car. And I think you can overdo it. And I always worry when a car company or people planning a new product get overly enamored with stuff like the connectivity of the car, and you can make restaurant reservations in advance, and you can have a party line chat with friends, and you can have sort of a chat room while you're driving, and we'll have it all on a touch screen and so forth. I worry about that stuff. First of all, the people that are less tech savvy don't use it, and I'm always worried that that stuff is going to displace other things in the car which are much more important for the primary excellence of the vehicle. And if the industry doesn't regulate itself on this driver distraction stuff, the government is going to step in massively and outlaw the whole business.
Yeah, they're already talking about doing just that. I'm not saying about outlawing it all, but definitely getting involved.
Yeah, it'll be regulated.
So maybe we ought to bring in another phone call here. Ben, let's bring in another one.
Yes, this is Rick from San Diego. I'd like to thank Mr. Lutz for taking time to speak with me at the GM Tech event in August of 2009 and thoroughly enjoyed talking with him about GM's future products. I am concerned, though, that without Bob, General Motors will slip into the old ways of general management by following the more bad answers path of an MBA mentality, short-term cost savings over long-term revenue generation. And that conflicts with the lean thinking that corrects root cause problems at the initial concept and design stages where they can be more effectively addressed. I was wondering if you thought that GM's management will give the designers and engineers the support and resources that they need to create more successful cars like the CTS and the Equinox. Thanks for your time.
Well, I do, because I will give Ed Whitaker's tenure at GM was very brief. He didn't know the business that well. He didn't pretend to know it, but he quickly took a look at what was working and what wasn't. And as a very smart guy, it didn't take him very long to figure out that the new generation of GM products, which were designed to be class-leading in every respect, were doing far better than the old generation of General Motors vehicles. And he said, why is that? And we explained it to him that we now had this focus on absolute product excellence. And he decided that we needed a sort of a corporate mission statement. And I thought, oh, my God, here we go. It is the mission of General Motors to serve the public, serve the government, serve society as a whole, protect the environment while providing reliable transportation to our millions of customers worldwide and so forth. It was none of that. And it took us about 5 minutes to come up with the mission statement, which is the mission of General Motors is to design, build, and sell the world's best cars and trucks. That's it. And everybody is very serious about that. The current senior management, Dan Eckerson is, and I think people, enough people at General Motors remember what happened under the old approach of trying to optimize the vehicle to where it was kind of good enough to get by. And then they marveled at the fact that it didn't sell unless you put $4,000 on it. And they now see the new generation of vehicles selling at, in some cases, no incentives or very low incentives and doing great in the marketplace and helping to reestablish General Motors' reputation. So a person would have to be pretty dumb not to realize that, hey, we did this for 30 years and it didn't work, and now we've been doing this other thing for 5 years and it does work. Why don't we continue with method B as opposed to going back to method A? So I think the lesson has stuck, and I'm confident that all future General Motors products are going to be outstanding and either at the top of their class or very close to it.
Another thing that you did that I found fascinating is you hired some automotive journalists, real good product guys.
Yeah.
And in fact, you once told me that you called them your secret weapon and that that's why GM's cars are as good as they are right now. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, we actually wanted to be, to not overexpose that, but what Jack Keebler and his group they call themselves the keepers of the corporate product excellence conscience. And what Jack and his team of guys will do is they will evaluate a vehicle at various stages during its development. And they'll talk to the chief engineers or actually all levels of engineer and say, look, what you've got here is very good, meets the requirements. It steers okay, it brakes okay, but go drive that BMW over there or go drive that Audi, and that's what I mean by really good sensitive steering, or that's what I mean by a really nice brake pedal that's hard and yet the braking is still progressive. And all of them have enough engineering background and that they are able to converse at that level. And they'll pick up, you know, minor subtleties in suspension tuning that they'll go back and talk to the engineers. And they do it in such a nice way that they always interface with that level. Of course, they write a final report, which goes to management, which is fine, but everybody concerned knows what they really think about the car before anybody in senior management gets to see it. And with that sort of cooperative approach, which is non-confrontational, it's not we want to make you guys look bad. We just want to help you make the car even better. And that has definitely given the recent GM cars, I think, that last 4 to 5% to take them from a 95% level where they meet all the, you know, they meet all the General Motors uniform test standards where there's ways to measure everything, brake feel, steering feel, and everything, to where you can make those grades, get passing grades on everything, and the car comes out sort of 95%. And then you get these professional car evaluators. They can give it another 4.5%. And that has, I think, contributed enormously to the slickness, silence, steering feel, brake feel, suspension characteristics It has been a very valuable exercise.
Very interesting approach, and one that I've never heard any other car company take.
Well,
before.
A lot of companies have sort of internal audit staffs that are separate from engineering and separate from planning and separate from design, who will do evaluations on a vehicle, but they're internal and they are not professional car evaluators, whereas these guys made successful livings evaluating cars. So you got Rick, you got Jack Keebler, Rich Seppas,
Ron Sessions,
Nick Twork, and Ron Sessions. And I think that building it up a little bit, and I think the idea is to expand it to China and Europe as well.
So let's bring in another phone call here, Ben. What you got up next?
Hi, this is Tom from Indiana. I have a question for Mr. Lutz. I'm a devoted GM customer, and I have several GM medium-duty trucks in my business. As you know, GM quit making any larger trucks than a one-ton and forced many GM lovers to go buy other brands to get a truck. Do you think GM will ever bring back the medium-duty trucks, even in the what they call 45 and 55 models? Gentlemen, keep up the good work. Thanks.
I never say never, but I think right now that GM has decided not to be in that business. I do know, though, that GM is looking at a global truck strategy for mediums, because we are absent from medium trucks basically all over the world, and it's a very... When I say we, I can't get rid of that. I'm supposed to be an impartial observer now. But you make a good point. GM did exit the business. We had a very tough time making money in that against the dedicated medium truck producers. But especially when you look at markets like China and other future emerging markets, there's an enormous unsatisfied demand for medium trucks, and it's a business that I know that GM is looking at right now to see if there's any potential for it.
What's that, class 4, 5, 6?
Yeah, where GMC was.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot of people looking at that business right now. It's pretty profitable right now.
Yeah, that's another thing. I mean, it's a very cyclical business. When you have an economic downturn, the margins evaporate, and because it's a deferrable purchase, and when companies are stressed, they just tell the fleet managers, make them last another 2 years, and the fleet manager does, because there's no emotional component to the purchase.
So tell us what you're doing now. You're on the board of Lotus, but you're also a contributor to CNBC?
I am a CNBC contributor, and if this were television, I think I probably would not have been allowed to appear. So I work with Phil LeBeau primarily,
yeah,
and
Phil.
He will probably be drawing on my services during the Detroit Auto Show. It is not a lucrative profession,
no,
but what it does is it sort of keeps me present in the television medium, and hopefully at some point it'll be good for book sales.
And what about Lotus? I mean, here they unleash this brace of concepts and production cars. And,
yeah.
You know, I just assume having one good Lotus or a couple would be good. And they show, this array of cars, very aggressive,
yeah,
optimistic. Some cases they're really cool looking cars, but
and all running prototypes.
Yeah,
the only one that wasn't a running prototype was the big four-door sedan.
Right,
and that was the one I encouraged him to put in the show because I thought that was the real showstopper.
Yeah,
and that was a foam model with non-see-through. Well, it's a very interesting company, as you know. It's owned by
Proton, right?
Proton, thank you. It's owned by Proton, which is the Malaysian government. And they looked at Lotus and said, we're building under 2,000 cars a year. It's an interesting engineering source for us, but Why is Lotus not growing? Why can't Lotus be more like Ferrari or more like Aston Martin to where we could get to 8,000 to 10,000 units a year? And they were willing to make a massive investment in Lotus, a massive investment in management. They got this guy who used to be commercial director of Ferrari, very capable young man by the name of Danny Bahar, a fellow Swiss. So we converse in Swiss German when we're together. They hired some brilliant engineering talent from the German companies. They got the former Ferrari chief designer. When you look at the ranks of top management, I think if you look at the top 20 people, I think I'm not sure that there's an Englishman in there anywhere. So it's a very international company, but they're dedicated to preserving the essence of Lotus, which is lighter weight, agility, derive the performance from smaller engines. They're committed to always having class-leading fuel economy in whatever they do. And it's not like they're just throwing money at it willy-nilly. I mean, they have milestones and a very solid business plan. I think their expectations per vehicle are relatively modest. For instance, the Elan and the new Elan and the new Elise, if executed, and they will be, as we saw in the shows, I think any one of those could globally attain 8,000 units. And yet their total ambition for all five models is 8,000 to 10,000 units. They're very well engineered. The cars will be make a great use of aluminum and carbon fiber. The bodies will all be carbon fiber, so they'll be heavier than today's Lotuses. But that's for two reasons. One, they have to meet all of the global, roof crush, dynamic side impact, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They also want to make a car that's easier to get in and out of than the Elise, so that it's accessible to more people. And that drives a certain amount of weight. But they want to be, they want to have a very substantial double-digit percentage weight advantage over global competition. They're also looking for a cost and list price advantage while delivering the same or more performance. And, of course, the Lotus emphasis has always been on handling and braking. That's the race car heritage, and that'll be preserved. So it's very exciting to be associated with them. And as the companies like Porsche and Ferrari become more and more mainstream brands, I think there is an opportunity for a new small niche company with a great heritage to make modest inroads in that. And again, we're not talking about Porsche volumes. We're talking about going from 2,000 a year to 10,000 a year. And if they can hit that, the company is going to be solidly profitable.
So is this exclusively Toyota Power going forward, or...?
I wouldn't say exclusively, but they have a very, very good relationship with Toyota. Toyota takes, I think, an extremely intelligent approach to the Lotus business, because they deliver the engine, and Lotus says, you realize we're going to do a lot of things to these engines. And Toyota says, well, be our guest. And they say, because we're going to turbocharge them to... We're going to take the V8 to 675 horsepower. And Toyota says, well, we wouldn't do it, but go ahead. And then the question is, well, what about the warranty? And Toyota says, no, we'll warrant them, which I think that's atypical for automobile companies. Normally, an automobile company selling engines will say, if you want it warranted, you install it the way we give it to you. And yet Toyota said, well, what's the risk? Out of 8.5 million cars a year, there's 2,000 Lotuses. So one or two blow up per year. That's not going to break the bank. So, but I think it's almost like Toyota must regard it as sort of an advanced engineering group that kind of pushes the envelope on the durability and power of Toyota engines. And I must say, they're very nice drivetrains. I'm going to get a Lotus Evora tomorrow for personal evaluation vehicle, and I'm quite looking forward to that.
The other thing that impresses me about Lotus is a lot of engineers via Lotus Engineering.
Well, it is. It's that's why it's called Group Lotus. And Group Lotus is really a group of companies. One is the heritage company that restores formula. That's the smallest part, but it's important.
That's Colin Chapman's son, right?
Exactly, yeah. And that does the restorations and the rebuilds of Lotus Formula One cars and services all those customers. And I think it's good that that's still there.
It's essential.
Part of the heritage.
It is, yeah. And why would you turn your back on all that? Then right now the biggest chunk is Lotus Engineering, which does a lot of, does the in-house engineering, but they also do contract work for others. And that's quite lucrative. And then the third company, of course, is the car company. And the car company is the one that they want to grow.
Hey, this is probably another good spot to take a break, talk about one of our other sponsors for the show, DowBetaMate.com. And you were talking about lightweight Lotuses. They have lightweight reinforcements they call Beta Brace, heat-curing polymer adhesive fiberglass composites. They're applied in fabrication plants and body and paint shops. They improve distortion resistance, flexural strength. I've never heard that term, flexural.
No, I haven't heard it either. I have a feeling it's been recently invented.
Yeah. But impact resistance and fatigue. Some of the benefits of using Beta Brace involve eliminating the need to retool sheet metal dies, provides exceptional stiffness compared to bare steel, and adheres to contoured surfaces. And you can get more information about that at DowBetaMate.com. And we got to talk about Bridgestone, too, another great sponsor of ours at BridgestoneTire.com. They're introducing their third-generation run-flat tires with groundbreaking new technology. Peace of mind for consumers. The added mass and stiffer sidewalls can compromise ride comfort and fuel efficiency, but the third generation of Bridgestone run-flat tires reduce all that, reduce heat, improve performance, and give you what you need in that regard. And again, you can get more information about that at BridgestoneTire.com. So what else are you
doing? I'm glad you didn't ask me for my opinion on the Dow Beta fillers or whatever you were talking about. Sounds good.
Yeah.
Should we do that call? Someone was calling about
okay.
Pontiac.
Yeah. Ben, how about another phone call here?
Hey, gang. This is Jake Cujo calling from Macomb, Michigan. And I'm just so excited to be able to have a question for Bob Lutz. I'm a diehard Pontiac fan, and I know they've gone away. I just got to know, was there anyone in the room that was fighting for Pontiac? And my second question, was it Cafe that killed the brand? Because there were a lot of rumors saying that they were going all-wheel drive or all-rear-wheel drive. And I was just wondering if it was just Cafe that just trashed those plans and that's why it couldn't go forward. I'd love to hear what you think, and have a great evening.
Thanks very much. That's a good question, and I will tell you that having grown up in the 50s and 60s and remembering the era of the wide-track Pontiacs and the GTOs and everything, I was a dedicated, diehard Pontiac fan, and I would say Pontiac is a brand that was killed by a lack of brand vision. You couldn't find anybody in the company in marketing, really, who had a clear-cut vision of what Pontiac should be. Or actually, we had two heads of the Pontiac division, but they were unable to prevail, and they were moved to other jobs. And in one case, hired away by Cincinnati Microwave, and so on. But with the constant change of heads of Pontiac division, each head of the Pontiac division had a different idea of what Pontiac should be. And it was, let's have a different alternative to Chevrolet with some styling modifications. Then the ultimate genius idea was Pontiac has to stop doing conventional cars. We've got to use the Pontiac has to be the General Motors Scion. And Pontiac has to do a whole bunch of cute little youth-style Nissan Cube-type things and Toyota Yarises and really cool stuff that the kids will love. The opposite end of the spectrum of every piece of Pontiac brand heritage. So throughout that, I just persisted in trying to make Pontiac what Pontiac should be, which would have been the affordable rear-wheel drive sports performance brand within General Motors. We got as far as the Solstice and the turbo version. We managed to get to the Solstice Coupe. By the way, I have one each. I have a Solstice Roadster and a Solstice Turbo Coupe. And we managed to get the G8 done. And then the next one was going to be a smaller sort of BMW 3-sized rear-wheel drive sedan, four cylinders only, with and without turbocharging, but with an extreme emphasis on sporty styling, great handling, just superb vehicle dynamics. Unfortunately, Chapter 11 kind of put an end to that because when Ratner and the team came in, they looked and said, how has the profitability of the brand been? Poor. How have the sales volumes gone? Well, kind of steadily downhill. Well, why would you keep that? Well, because we think it's turning around. You know, the G8 was just starting to reestablish Pontiac's credentials in the performance sedan market and so forth. But when you're talking to a bunch of private equity guys to say that, hang with us, this brand is about to turn around, that doesn't cut it. They just say, all we look at is the history. Sales have been going down. Profitability is lousy. Whack it.
They wanted to whack GMC, too, didn't they?
They wanted to whack GMC, too, right.
Then you showed them the profitability numbers.
Yep. Yep. Then, curiously, they said to the board, they said, but GMC trucks are not that different from Chevrolet trucks. Correct. Well, but then it's only marketing. Why would you have it then? And Neville Isdell is a terrific board member at GM and very outspoken former chairman of Coca-Cola Company. He says, only marketing? What do you think Coca-Cola is?
That's a good line.
Yeah. So GMC got saved, and a good thing, too, because that's a rapidly growing brand with a great brand equity and a very valuable brand. Saturn was hard to argue because we had put a ton of money into Saturn, given them the best product line they ever had, to where at the time of Chapter 11, the Saturn Sky was the oldest product in the mix. You know, you have to think about that. And the Saturn Aura had been Car of the Year. The Saturn Outlook, medium size or medium to large sport utility, was, to my way of thinking, was the best of the batch. I mean, when somebody in my family said, which one should I buy, the Acadia, the Enclave, or the Outlook, I said, take a look at them all, but you look at the interior of the Outlook. It's so beautiful. At any rate, Saturn had a great product line, but somehow that Saturn distribution system just could not translate that into volume. So I was sort of getting despondent about Saturn, because if good product is supposed to fix it, the good product was there, and it was not getting fixed. So when they said whack Saturn, it was hard. That was hard to argue against. Hummer was hard to argue against, and Hummer is just was a victim of the times. With,
but, you know, my contention is
anthropogenic global warming concerns.
Yeah, but if I had the money,
the lightning pole of the nation's left.
If I had the money, I'd have a car company that we sold Pontiacs and Hummers.
and probably make a lot of money at it.
Well, I mean, Hummer brand, GM managed to seed the Hummer brand, a very prestigious brand, everywhere else but in the U.S., right?
Yep.
And it's too bad, because I thought the H4 concept was brilliant.
Oh, Dynamite, yeah.
And
it was headed for production.
And it was just, it's just a shame.
Yep.
It really is.
It is a shame, but... look, when you, the problem is when you're in Chapter 11, you're sort of in a begging mode. You know, you're in no position to make demands.
Hey, you know, we always devote part of the show to a lot of questions from the audience. We call it rapid fire. We try to get through them real fast, and I think we ought to get to that. But first, let's take care of our last sponsor that we haven't gotten to yet, and then we'll jump right into rapid fire. And I've got to talk a little bit right now about. The Hyundai Sonata at HyundaiSonata.com. Terrific car, gives you all kinds of stuff. 2.4 liter, 200 horsepower, 186 pound-feet of torque. And that's a four-cylinder that gets 35 miles to the gallon. And then you can get the 2.0 turbo GDI, takes it up a notch. 74 more horses, takes it up to 274, 269 pound-feet of torque. That's 33 miles to the gallon. Pretty terrific package, and check it out at HyundaiSonata.com. But, Ben, let's bring up that rapid-fire graphic, and let's get going on that. Okay, Dan wants to know, which of the cars created under your direction is your favorite? I guess maybe we touched on it. That was a Peter question.
Yeah, right? I mean, I love them all, but the one that stands out and was the most difficult to get through the system was the Volt.
Goggles Pisano wants to know, do you still get time to fly your jet, and who would win a dogfight in identical P-51s, you or Jack Roush?
I think since Jack Roush is down to one eye, I think I'd win that one now.
comment from Chevy Rules. What are your thoughts on the Lotus Evora problems with burning through clutches due to the 3.5-liter V6 from Toyota not designed to be mated to a manual?
I haven't, to tell you the truth, I'm stumped. I hadn't heard anything about that.
Yeah. Artemis 77, why don't auto execs understand small trucks?
They don't. I'm a little stumped on that one.
Yeah, okay.
And I don't know what a small truck is.
I think they're thinking like Canyon, Cheyenne, Ranger.
All right. I'll tell you why they have difficulty understanding them is because everybody has kind of difficulty selling them. Because,
everybody.
With the level of incentives on large trucks, the daylight between the so-called medium or small size pickups and the large ones, there isn't a lot of daylight in there anymore. So that it's very easy for people to opt up to full size.
Jim wants to know, did you read Overhaul by Steve Rattner?
I read enough of it to satisfy my curiosity.
I won't read it. Or what I've actually told people is don't buy it because the guy doesn't deserve any money.
Well, I think with that, you probably if he becomes a forbidden good, people will probably, you've probably done Steve Rattner a favor.
Well, I've told people, go to the library and take it out of the library, but don't pay for the book.
Okay, enough said about that. This is supposed to be rapid fire.
Yeah, that's right.
No editorial comment.
Here's a good one from Tom Stahlkamp.
Oh.
Who says, I've got two questions for Bob. Number one, many of us know that you were hesitant, quote unquote, about the quote unquote merger with Daimler. Do you think Chrysler could have made it on its own after 2000?
Yes, I do. But what was very quickly lost was a lot of the discipline and a lot of the focus on product excellence. And the Germans did Chrysler no favors. I continue to believe Chrysler was of a size. Was reputationally intact, had a brilliant lineup, a brilliant design and engineering organization, and I definitely believe that that was an ill-conceived merger in the final analysis. The synergies were very limited, as they always are across oceans, and it was kind of sad. But I'm frankly very pleased to see the resurgence of Chrysler, and it's based on great products again.
What do you make of Sergio Marchionne and what he's doing with
the company? I have a great deal of admiration for him. I think he's a brilliant executive. He certainly turned Fiat around, and I knew that when I saw the first of the Fiat Cinquecentos in Europe, I looked at the interior, looked at the materials, looked at the fits, looked at the paint, looked at the body gaps, and I said, somebody here is serious about doing great vehicles with high levels of quality. And, you know, the Fiat reputation, the fix-it-again, Tony thing is gone in Europe. Fiat is well reestablished, and I think, I don't know whether Sergio Marchionne is a car guy or not, but he certainly is focused on the right things. And you look at the new Grand Cherokee, that new Grand Cherokee
looks good.
Is a superb piece of automotive design and execution.
That was done before he got there.
Well, yes, but or it was substantially done.
No, it
but,
was basically
but at least
done.
At least there was no effort to cost optimize it or anything. The vehicle is somebody there is serious about doing great products. And my personal prediction is Chrysler will come back beyond anybody's expectations.
I agree. Second part to Tom Stallcamp.
But not the Sebring. Or the
200. The 200, yeah.
I look at a 200
and I say, a piece of shit is a piece of shit, okay? I'm sorry.
I look at the 200 and I say, that's a Sebring. What is
if you don't change that greenhouse, you're not going to do...
Right. No, don't say that. It's not the greenhouse. It's the greenhouse is there to take your mind off the rest of the car.
Okay, Stallcamp also asks, how can Opel become profitable if they have to keep their German plants operating at the expense of more efficient plants?
Well, if whoever has the solution to that would probably be very welcome in Dan Ackerson's office. He'd like to hear that. That is a problem. Opel was, I think, missed the window in getting out from under the German manufacturing base. And Volkswagen kept talking, oh, we are German, we are German, we're here. And meanwhile, they were heading east so fast it made your head spin. Opel kind of never was, maybe it was they were never willing to take the short-term agony to do. I mean, some of it is the plant in Hungary, plant in Poland, and so forth. But it kind of missed the boat on getting out from under the high-cost German. And now with the euro, I mean, you combine a German labor and supplier costs with a high euro, it's amazing that anybody can sell a German car outside of Europe.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, that's a problem. I know it's on one of the things that's on the top of Dan Ackerson's list.
Stallcamp also says, thanks and wish Bob the best. He was a great boss, certainly the better of the two Bobs.
Hey, thanks a lot, Tom.
Ray Rand says, you're on Transonic Combustion's board of directors.
Yeah.
He'd like to know if any of the car companies have bought a license.
Nobody has bought a license yet, but there's interest from every major car company, and almost every major car company has engines running at Transonic.
And explain a little bit about all is.
We all know about HCCI, or homogeneous charge compression ignition, where you make a gasoline engine run like a diesel. The problem is, despite everybody's best efforts, and upping the injection pressures to astronomical PSIs, you're not going to get the complete vaporization that permits consistent running in the HCCI regime, which is why if you could get HCCI running properly, you could get about a 25% fuel economy gain, the same as you get with a diesel. The problem is HCCI won't work at idle. It won't work at full load. It won't work in the transients. And hopefully it can be made to work with the cruise control set to 65 miles an hour on a level highway. And that's why they're looking at about a 5% gain in fuel economy. What Transonic, the invention of Transonic is to preheat the fuel to 400 degrees centigrade prior to the injection pulse so that when the fuel comes out, it's not gas and it's not liquid, it's a plasma. And it results in a very, very complete combustion. Transonic can demonstrate engines idling in the HCCI regime, full load, full acceleration, top speed, always in HCCI, so the 20 to 25% is absolutely assured. It does require some beefing up of the engine because you're running at diesel engine loads, so companies that have both a gasoline block and a diesel block will probably want to use the diesel block. But the technology works. Everybody realizes it works. There are some engineering problems to be solved, like injector longevity and so forth. But these are, it's now down to the level of solving engineering problems. There are no conceptual problems. This really works. And engines, you know, we all talked about stoichiometry, 14-to-1 fuel air ratio or air fuel ratio and so forth. I've seen the engines that Transonic run smoothly at 60-to-1 AFR.
Whoa.
Of course, at 60-to-1 AFR, the NOx goes way up. So to control the NOx, it has to be dialed back to about 25 or 30 AFR. But it is pretty amazing technology.
But that's extremely lean.
Oh, that's way beyond lean burn. Way, way, way beyond lean burn.
And that's how you get the fuel economy improvement.
Yeah. And when you look at everybody's going to have to get 25 or 30% minimum to meet the future CAFE laws. This is going to be the most cost-effective way of getting that 25 to 30%, more cost-effective than going to a diesel and certainly more cost-effective than a hybrid gas electric because of all of the battery cost and the fact that you got basically two powertrains.
Yeah. Let's see. We've got another one here. From George from Sunnyvale says, were you involved in getting Cadillac out of the Luxo boat business and into the sport sedan business? If so, how hard was it to get everyone on board?
No, that was...
That started before you.
Yeah, that was really the joint effort of John Smith, who at the time was head of the Cadillac division, and Wayne Cherry, who at the time was chief designer. And the two of them had this vision for the new Cadillac, which would be iconically American in design, but with the driving characteristics of the best European sports sedans. So that happened before I got there, but I certainly aided and abetted it once I was there. And the one thing I do take credit for was getting the small block into the CTS, because the view was, well, we can't put a small block in a Cadillac. Why? Well, because it's a pushrod engine and Cadillac has to be high tech. And I said, but that's a CTS with a small block is going to, especially now the new CTS-V with the supercharged small block, is going to make a great car. Yeah, but we want technology. We want a 3.6 liter V6 with twin turbochargers and a lot of plumbing so that... And we'll get the horsepower that way. And it would have been way more expensive and a lot, way more engineering and a lot less satisfactory solution. And even the first CTS-V with the 440 horsepower Corvette engine, it was a little rough around the edges, but it was a great car to drive.
Great package.
And the new one, of course, with the supercharged engine is a superb piece of automotive engineering. I mean, it just doesn't get any better than a CTS-V.
We agree, don't we?
Yeah. I mean, it's just such a pleasure to drive. It's so silky. And then when you step into it, it's this incredible rush of power. So I think Cadillac's on the right path.
Yellow 430 wants to know, what words of wisdom and what advice would you give to a young person entering the automotive industry today?
Get yourself a good education.
Not an MBA.
Not an MBA. Engineering is good. If you have design talent, that's another good way in. If you have marketing capability or product planning capability, those are all good stuff. But the main thing is to get yourself enough educational credentials to where you can get in the door. And once you're in the door, hard work and automotive passion and working towards the right goals and delivering will take care of the rest.
Let's get into some of the more the phone calls here. But a guy named Todd Cruz wants to know, how would you suggest Fiat market Alfa Romeos in the U.S.?
Well, that's a tough one, and I've often asked myself the same thing. They're going to have to go extremely high-end because they unless they decide to produce them in Mexico or some place, which they might, but if they're going to come from Europe, they're going to be very expensive due to the euro. So
I think PX is going to buy Alfa from Sergio.
I don't think it's for sale. If I were Marchione, I sure wouldn't sell it.
It's losing money.
Well,
what flabbergasts me is it's a money loser.
And then I think Alfa would face a relatively difficult time in the United States because we, who have been around for a long time, especially me, but we remember Alfa Romeo, and the name has a lot of meaning to us. It carries a lot of mystique. But, you know, we're increasingly in a minority because the car's been gone from the United States for, 30 or 40 years.
And it's never going to be a mainstream car.
No, so they may as well price it high and do like Maserati or
something. Well, the 8C Competizione is a beautiful car. They should have kept selling those here.
Okay, Ben, let's bring in another phone call here.
Hello, this is John Dunlap. You haven't said anything about where you think hybrids are going to end up. Personally, I think EVs, electric vehicles, are done before they start. But I think hybrids do have with some real potential when they get updated. Any rate, my name is John Dunlap. I'm from Hillbilly in the Ozarks. Thank you very much for your wonderful show.
Didn't we have that call last week?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
Well, I think there's a place for hybrids, and there's going to be massive hybridization due to the upcoming fuel economy requirements where larger vehicles like full-size pickup trucks are simply not going to make the rules unless they're hybridized in some form. The problem with hybrids is even at current fuel prices, which in the United States we may think that $3.25 a gallon is expensive, the Europeans would find it a bargain because they're paying between $7 and $8 a gallon. If we start getting $7 and $8 a gallon fuel, more Americans will be willing to pay the premium for a hybrid vehicle. But as it stands, people sort of mentally do the computation and they say, well, I can get the piston engine one for $25,000, but the hybrid is $30,000. Let's see, how many years do I have to drive to amortize that additional $5,000? And the answer is forever. So I think it's over time, a total hybrid market in the United States, including pure electrics. There's various estimates, but I think within the next 10 years, if it's 10% of the market, I think that would surprise a lot of people. So I think it's important technology. It's technology that whether you're a fan of it or not, all automobile companies are going to be forced into fairly high levels of hybridization just to meet the law, which is going to raise the price of vehicles. So yes, they have a future. But it's a future that will be greatly improved by rising gas prices.
I don't know. It's to me, you know, I keep saying this. Here we are, a dozen years since the first hybrid came out. There's still just a little over 2% of the market. If you talk about
the Prius sales, I think
they've softened. They had a good month last month, but as you know, the Prius is half the hybrid market. Yeah. That one car is half the market.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just don't see them catching on. And the United States buys more hybrids than the rest of the world, I think, just about put together.
Yeah.
And that's really raises questions in my mind about how EVs are going to sell. I think the Volt is a great compromise.
The Volt
but
is
pure
great
EV.
Because it's no excuses and it'll do everything.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to drive purely electric and you have, say, a 40-mile commute.
You have to start thinking about it.
Yeah. And with a total range of 300 miles, I mean, it can serve as your only car, and yet for short trips, you'll never use a drop of gasoline. I have my doubts sort of on the, I hate to say this, but I have my doubts about the commercial success of the Nissan Leaf, because they advertise 100 miles, but that's sort of with new batteries and under optimal conditions and a very careful driving style. I think the average for the average person on the average day with a two-year-old battery in L.A. traffic and so forth is probably going to be more like 65 to 70 miles. I may be wrong, but I don't think so. And that's going to produce a lot of range anxiety, and it kind of limits the utility of the vehicle. I think future generations of lithium-ion batteries and the follow-on technology will see energy storage in batteries increase probably by a factor of three, so that a Nissan Leaf, instead of looking at a nominal 100, real-world 70, will be more like a nominal 300, real-world 220. Then you're starting to get to the same level of utility as conventional automobiles. You know, never forget that. If we get serious about the electrification of the automobile, it can be done by putting in a lot of nuclear power stations, which will permit us to generate unlimited electrical energy. Then we can start putting inductive wires in the highways so that you drive on your battery to the freeway. Once you're on the freeway, you click freeway, and the car gets its energy from the embedded inductive cable, and you're, you know, zipping down the freeway at 80 miles an hour with electricity, and then when you hit the off-ramp, you're back on your own battery again. These things are all feasible, but I think they're quite a ways out.
And when you talk about hybridization, especially in trucks, are you talking strong hybrids or this stop-start technology?
I've been gone for 9 months and a lot changes in, not quite 9 months, but I've been gone for a while and a lot changes. But I will say that to do a full-size pickup that's going to meet the 2020 and 2025 fuel economy regulations, they're just not going to do it without a battery pack.
Wow.
And a strong hybrid.
That's a lot of cost to add
yes.
to a car 10, or a
000,
truck.
10,000.
Whew, man.
Going off the grid, John.
Right. Run it on you corn cobs.
You want to save the planet, don't you?
I'm going off the grid, Bob. I'll meet you out on 14 late at night in our supercars, muscle cars.
I'll bring my ZR1.
Yeah.
Ben, let's bring in another phone call here.
Yes, this is Mike from Pensacola, Florida, calling Mr. Lutz. Thing along the lines of a flagship sedan or flagship sedans, how can the domestic manufacturers expect to be considered legitimate in the car side of the business without a flagship rear-wheel drive sedan, especially in the luxury segment? Thank you. Appreciate the time, guys.
Yeah, by the way, I went through flight training in Pensacola, Florida, so that place has a lot of fond memories for me. Actually, that is a topic of considerable discussion and study at General Motors now, because while Cadillac is accepted as is in the United States and is making good progress with the product lineup it has now, in order to gain a better foothold in China, what we hear from GM China is, we must have the large flagship sedan, the Cadillac equivalent to the BMW 7 or the Mercedes S-Class. or the Audi A8, which interestingly enough isn't rear-wheel drive, but they somehow managed to pull it off anyway. Great car, by the way. So the conundrum is, how do you get sufficient volume to not lose hundreds of millions of dollars a year on the thing? Because the BMW 7 and the Mercedes S-Class are not exactly burning up the charts these days. So that end of the business is nowhere near as lucrative as it used to be. Maybe the solution lies in going extremely high-end, more or less like Bentley, German Bentley, not British Bentley, and do something in the $150,000, $160,000 area and kind of limit the volume and to where the inevitable losses would be relatively small, to where you could ascribe it to almost marketing or a vehicle that, okay, so it costs us $100 million a year, but it helps us reestablish the preeminence of Cadillac. I think it would have to be looked at partly that way. I know they're wrestling with it at GM right now. Mm-hmm. And it is, I don't think it's, contrary to what the caller's question, I don't think it's essential for the United States. It may well be essential for China.
What do you think, Pierre?
I absolutely would do a flagship Cadillac.
You would what?
I would do a flagship Cadillac.
You would?
Yeah.
And Ben, let's bring in another one here.
Hi, Dylan. This is Frank from Long Island. I have a question. I'd like to know what everyone on the panel drives, what their family drives, and if
That's
Bob Lutz is obligated to have only General Motors cars in his driveway. Thanks. Bye.
Bob's got a wonderful garage.
Should I go first?
You should go first. The show's about you.
Well, as of tomorrow, I'll have a Lotus Evora. And I've got a Cadillac CTS wagon, which I love dearly. I think it's, if I had to pick one car, my only car, it would be that CTS all-wheel drive wagon. Plenty of performance, wonderful handling, good traction in snow and ice and so forth. I mean, it does everything you want a car to do. Then I have a Chevy Tahoe and a GMC pickup. And I will honestly tell you, even if I did not have the GM heritage, I would still probably, knowing what I know now and my involvement with all these vehicles, I would continue to buy GM cars almost exclusively. I also have a Corvette CR1, which I bought. The Tahoe I bought also. And the CTS wagon is the only kind of still company-supplied car. And I've got a Hummer H3, which I, again, love dearly, would never give up. Pontiac Solstice Roadster and a Pontiac Solstice Turbo Coupe. And then let's not get into all, yeah.
All the collector cars.
All the old cars. All right. Few of which are GM. One LaSalle convertible.
Oh, LaSalle.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
34 mm-hmm. LaSalle. It's gorgeous.
So, yeah, we don't need to get into our stuff, too. Let's do one more phone call here. And
aren't you driving a Chevy Cruze right now?
I'm not. One of the other guys here on the staff has got that. I'm actually driving the new Dodge Durango, which I'm very impressed by.
Yeah, well, it's the Cherokee.
Right. It is the Grand Cherokee, exactly. But that's just one of the test vehicles because it's up for Truck of the Year, and that's why I'm in that one right now.
Okay, yeah, and they already know I have an Audi S4 and a Ford Fiesta.
And I've got a Citroen DS, too. So, Ben?
That's an interesting piece of automotive history.
Oh, it is. It is. It's
That is a demonstration of what happens when you let the engineers go unfettered.
Well, a guy told me.
Finance guys should have stepped in.
Long time ago. I heard that General Motors in 1970 tore down a Citroen DS just to figure out how was this thing put together, and they did a cost estimate of what it would cost General Motors in 1970 to build a DS, and they figured that it would cost them somewhere between $10,000 and $12,000.
Yeah.
And I think Citroën was selling them for $5,000. Yeah. So it's great to have the French government picking up the bill for the rest of it.
Yeah, well, it was certainly not a moneymaker, and it was a reliability nightmare.
Mine hasn't been too bad, actually.
Well, you know, you replace all those seals with modern rubber and plastic compounds. I mean, nowadays you could make that car reliable, but back then you couldn't.
But it's a pretty cool car that, you know, today you do everything electronically as well, and that's just this Rube Goldberg of a design of mechanical stuff.
But it's pretty neat when it squats.
Oh, and
what's neat is for changing a tire, you'd lower the car all the way to the ground, then you'd pull the circuit breaker on the flat tire, and then you'd raise the suspension to its maximum height, and it was like a dog taking a pee. It would just the wonder where you pull the circuit breaker, it would just pull it off the ground, and people could actually drive them on three wheels.
Three wheels. Yeah, exactly right, exactly right. So, Ben, let's take one more phone call here, and we'll wrap it up.
Hi, this is Nick from Manalapan, New Jersey. And I just want to thank Bob Lutz for returning General Motors to where it was when I was growing up, a really great car company. My question to him is if he can relate the story of when he was at Opel in Germany about the Chevrolet V8s not really maintaining their reliability in their German counterparts. Thank you. Love your show. Bye.
Oh, that was kind of funny because we put first of all, it was a 283 small block in the Opel Diplomat, which was Opel will never be successful unless it has a flagship sedan to compete with the large Mercedes. So we built this very large car and had a small block Chevy in it, and which was had bulletproof reliability in the United States in a speed-limited environment. And then people would get them out on the Autobahn, didn't have an oil cooler, didn't have sufficient oil capacity, et cetera, didn't have sodium-cooled exhaust valves and so forth. And the guys would take them out on the Autobahn, 200 kilometers an hour, which was a good top speed back in those days, equivalent to about 125. And after about a half an hour, the engine would blow up. So it was back to the General Motors parts bin and say, we need more reliability for these engines. Give us the premium parts, you know. And they said, well, we'll give you the police interceptor package. That's the best we can do. So we got engines with the police interceptor package and tested those. And instead of blowing up after half an hour, they blew up after an hour. And so then it was, what else can we do? And they said, what the hell? We never have engine failures in the United States. They said, well, you don't understand. They drive full throttle on the Autobahn for an hour at a time. I mean, it's like max pedal to the metal for hours after hour, hour after hour, traffic permitting. They said, well, these people are insane. You have to tell your customers not to drive like that. We said, well, you know, Mercedes gets out on the Autobahn and the customers kind of like the top speed. So we finally got the help of the Chevrolet Racing Division, and we got small blocks that incorporated the forged connecting rods, the forged pistons, the sodium-cooled exhaust valves. I mean, we had all of the what in the United States would be racing technology in engines that we put in a production sedan. And those then, of course, had bulletproof reliability. Huh. But that was back in the days when U.S. engines were really built for the American driving environment. You know, we also had to do a cast aluminum oil pan with sort of ears, finned ears out the side. It was a beautiful sight. I mean, the Opel version of the Chevys, we went to the 327 later on. The Opel version of the 327 was beautiful to look at with all finned aluminum stuff for heat dissipation, oil cooler. And it was like a full race setup, and those engines were really reliable. But in the States, it just didn't matter because nobody ever drove sustained high speeds. When I was ahead of GM France sales in 66 or 67, we had the first of the Pontiac Firebirds with the Firebird 400, you know, with the big block. And we had these wealthy Parisians come in and they'd buy a Pontiac Firebird 400 convertible and they'd drive by their mistress's house, put the babe in, and head down the autoroute to the south of France. And we'd get a phone call from Lyon or someplace saying, the engine experienced spontaneous disassembly. I mean, all of these big block things that we had in the States in the 60s that we all loved so much, by European standards, they had zero durability. And I think that's what basically soured many Europeans on U.S. products, is that under European driving conditions, they simply didn't hold up. Now they do, because now everything is designed for full throttle, full load, 500 hours and so forth. I mean, there's, in terms of high load durability, there's no longer any difference. In fact, when we had that CTSV challenge at...
in New York?
Yeah.
Monticello, was it?
Monticello. The CTSVs were, like, out of the showroom. Showroom rubber, showroom brakes, nothing added, nothing taken away. And they do lap after lap after lap after lap. The temperature gauge didn't move. The oil pressure gauge didn't move. The brakes didn't fade. And some of the European stuff did not fare so well. In fact, some of it we had to go out to mid-course and bring it back. And one European company, where several journalists were going to borrow products from the company, the company shall remain nameless, the company said, "We are. If you're planning to go to Monticello for the CTSV challenge, you can't have the car." And the answer was, why? Because our cars, as sold to the public, are not ready, are not in racing condition. So it's kind of interesting that we've had that reversal.
Yeah, the pendulum has swung the other way some here. Well, real good. Bob, it's been terrific having
you
here.
You.
It's really good. I mean, we could go on and on and on here, but I think this is a good place to wrap
thank
it all up.
Thank you very much. It's two of my favorite guys. And
cool.
It's always good to see you without glasses, because every time I see you, I'm reminded of
the Coke bottles that I used to wear.
Your Coke bottle bottoms. And I
right.
told them, why don't you talk to my wife? She went to Canada and got the laser surgery.
And I did.
He did talk to her.
I talked
did
to her.
Get him to go on.
That's before it was even legal here in the U.S. to do LASIK surgery. Had to go to Windsor, Canada to get it done. Exactly right. So that was terrific. Peter, great having you here again, as always, too. It's a great show. And just to remind everybody, you can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/OutOfLineDetroit, twitter.com/OutOfLine. Get to Peter's stuff at autoextremist.com. And
still on Twitter. I don't know why.
Oh, okay. twitter.com/AutoExtremist. Yeah. Just for those who want to know. Thanks, everyone.
Visit our website, outoflinedetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Autoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at outoflinedetroit.tv.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. Dow Automotive Systems, improving durability and increasing design flexibility with Betamate structural adhesives at DowBetamate.com. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.